freaking auto!
This is Brock and Salk.
Brock Huard is my hero.
What Brock Huard says?
No, he's not a friend of mine.
Subscribe to receive every episode at Apple Podcasts or on Google Podcasts.
Ah, we stink, man.
Now, here are your hosts, Brock Huard and Mike Salk.
No way!
Well, here we go with another Brock and Salk podcast. Hi, buddy.
Hi.
How are things?
Things are great.
Ready for Jake Heaps here in a little while? Making his podcast debut?
The guru, the agent.
Yeah.
The advisor.
All the above. Yeah.
I'm a little jealous. I'm not going to lie. I mean, I'm a little jealous. He and Wyman have been out there a lot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the 10, 11 years of doing the show, that was one of the highlights always, is in the month of August, watching you shiver when it's like in the upper 50s in the morning. And, oh, I'm so cold. And then it would warm up and the sun would come up and then we get to watch practice for hours. I mean, August was a special month. So yeah, there's, I'll be totally frank, a little jealous. He and Wyman are out there actually watching it go down.
I don't miss those mornings at all.
Gosh, you used to whine every day.
I absolutely hate being outside in the cold for that long. I hate it. I can't stand it. You ever hear me whine later in the day about it being hot?
Nope.
Not one time. You ever hear me in Phoenix whine about it being hot?
No, too bright.
I don't think I've ever.
Well, it's hard
ever.
To see the computer.
Sun's too bright.
Hold on.
Too much sun.
Hold
now.
On.
Too little sun then.
No, that was just a challenge of doing the job that we had to work through, but not about my feeling, not about the temperature.
No. Nope.
Never. Never. 120 degrees. Let's go. Bring it on. 50
with
degrees
ash,
outside
with ash
the wind
and smoke in the air, and you still don't. In
I love
fact,
the smoke.
You chide people for not wanting to get out and run in the ash and
Mark,
smoke.
Whoa. Smells like victory. Like, I'm in. I love it. But the cold in the morning, at
Jake was out there last week in the rain. Midday, it was 1 p.m., 60-something degrees, and I had to bring it up. I was like, Jake. Now, Mike Salk was out there at 6 a.m.
Yeah.
48 degrees.
Terrible.
Wind, rain, like
four
you're,
layers.
You're fine, Jake.
Remember when I started bringing the parka?
Well, then you'd start making, bring the equipment back inside. We're going indoors.
We're going in.
Perfectly
clear day.
Here.
We got to go inside.
We can't be out here at least until 10 o'clock when the sun's up.
Those were the days.
All right. So here we go. So before we get to Jake, I have a new game for us, Brock. And the way I did it is sort of a way of digging into a few of our stories. I've got some Mariner stuff I wanted to get to, some Seahawks stuff, obviously, with practice and continuing on. And so I came up with a little game. It doesn't need any music. I hope it goes better than Kick It or Punt It. Remember when you were...
Still not that bad.
Yeah, I know.
I'm so with Mike.
Thank
Love
you.
Love Kick It or Punt It.
I know.
I'm punting that every day.
Thanks.
I'm kicking it.
So this is like when you were a kid. I think that's when I remember first learning this, when you have to... do a mystery. Kids are big into mysteries.
Nancy Drew.
Right. Hardy Boys.
Boxcar
Children.
Yes, obviously the box. Encyclopedia Brown.
For sure.
You must have loved him.
Yeah, well,
him,
Dave Wyman still calls me. Hey, Encyclopedia Brown, who started for the Rams in 2012?
So you'd have to do who, what, where, when, and why, and how, right? Those are the things you would have to, the questions you would ask to try
say
to
that
learn.
Again.
Who, what, where, when, why, and how. Who,
oh,
what,
you said it right the first time. When, who, what, where. When, where, why, and how. But yeah. Uh-huh.
What, where, when, why, and how.
Who, what, when, where, why, and how.
Right. Who, what, where, when, why, and how. Okay. Anyway, so I thought we could ask each other each of those six questions about different topics. So we each came up with a question for each of the five W's and the H that gets thrown. It's like the Y and the vowels. It's like sometimes there.
It's an outlier. It's tacked on the end.
All right. So, Brock, I will start. Who does Jamal Adams remind you of?
Ooh, he's loud, man. He is. I think that is the one thing over 2 weeks, loud personality, loud talent, loud hitter, loud. And Cam wasn't loud. Earl wasn't necessarily loud. I've said he's a blend of those two. He's kind of the birth child of Cam and Earl from a football skill set standpoint.
Is he a little more of the mix of Cam and Richard though? From an overall standpoint.
Yes.
Yeah, that's where I was going.
I think Richard probably. I'd have to physically just size wise, obviously more Cam-ish. But I think, and I don't think it was, I mean, it was spur of the moment, but as you watch them in their mock game, run out of the tunnel and be there and get ready to play, who did Russell turn to? Who broke the team? It was Jamal Adams. It wasn't Bobby. It wasn't KJ. It was Jamal, who's, I think, going to take that voice and be loud and be willing to be out front as much as anybody since Richard. So, yeah, that would probably be my answer.
Well, I think that's a perfect answer, right? I mean, if he's got someone, we're going to talk a little bit more about Cam today, because the stuff going on with Earl, I think, in many ways makes Cam look better and better, and we can talk through that. But if he's got some of the Cam skill set, a little of the Earl skill set and the playmaking, and then you add in some of the Richard Sherman energy and loudness, God, I'm so excited for Jamal Adams. Like, I really am. He's kind of combining the best of all three of those guys.
It's like you're a Frankenstein football player.
Isn't he?
He's your perfect guy.
He really is. I'm so excited for him. He takes all three of those players, takes the best out of them, and combines it. Now, I may be eating these words later, you know, as maybe the personality isn't what we want it to be. Who the heck knows? It takes time. I know in New York, they think he's a disaster, of course, because, you know, he left. But
when adversity comes, well, ultimately we'll know when there's a little adversity.
Sure.
When times get tough and when they lose and he gets beat and something negative happens or there's some negative noise around and their run D and the D line can't stop anybody.
When
you know,
punches when a teammate. I'm sorry. I'm wrapped up in the whole thing. But as of now, he seems perfect. He's got all three of those guys.
Who is the most valuable? Here's my who. Who is the most valuable Seahawk not named Russell Wilson?
Jadeveon. Oh, sorry. Darn it. Son of a gun. God, get that one wrong every time. Mike, slap your wrist.
He's not here,
Mike. Not here. Gosh. They can't afford to be without him.
Who is the most valuable Seahawk not named Russell?
This is the when we would do it every year. The guy you can least afford to lose, right? The most irreplaceable?
Most irreplaceable.
The most irreplaceable Seahawk not named Russell Wilson.
Because you're seeing every day somebody go down around the league, right?
It was
Grant Delpit yesterday, tears his Achilles. We've seen torn ACLs. We've seen busted labrums. We've seen all sorts of soft tissue injuries. Who two and a half weeks out from the opening kick
in
Atlanta?
I'll give you one on offense and one on defense. On defense, this is an easy answer. The most irreplaceable Seahawk is Jaron Reed.
Yes.
And it's not close.
Yes. Yes.
It's not that he's the best Seahawk. Don't get me wrong. This is about irreplaceability. It's Jaron Reed, and it's not close. If he gets hurt, you've got, you know, Christmas. Christmas come early. Like, it's
Christmas
not...
mirror.
It's a Monet Christmas,
a nightmare
man. Let's
before
go.
Christmas.
So, it's clearly Jaron Reed on defense. Clearly, yeah. Not close.
Okay.
On offense, harder question, because I think they've got built up depth to handle a lot of what could go wrong. I think on the offensive line, there's enough kind of, you know, one guy's sort of similar enough to the next. Dwayne Brown is always going to be up there.
He's way up there.
They can handle the loss of a running back. They've built that room up enough, and they got 27 tight ends, so I think they'd be fine. If it's not Dwayne Brown, it's Tyler Lockett. I think I would go with Tyler Lockett.
Yeah.
Just because of the depth at that position and what he means and all the different ways they use him, I would go with Tyler Lockett, followed really, really closely by Dwayne Brown.
And emotionally, if they were to lose DK, it would emotionally feel the hardest to swallow. Tyler and Dwayne have both been out.
Sorry,
Tyler's,
I got news for you. I'm ready for that.
Tyler's
I'm emotionally prepared because I think it's going to happen.
Catastrophic injuries. Dwayne Brown has fought through injuries. He's at the stage of his career where, you know, every week it's going to be just put the body together to be there Sunday to play. But just emotionally, if something were to happen to DK, because of his playmaking, his upside, his growth, been the star of camp again like he was a year ago, man, emotionally, that'd be the toughest for me to handle.
All right, Brock, what should the Mariners do with Taiwan Walker? This is my what question. What should the Mariners do with Taiwan Walker? There are rumors out there that that he's on the trading block and some teams are interested. What should the Mariners do with Taiwan Walker?
Yeah, they should trade him.
Immediately.
Mm-hmm.
What if I told you that the market for him isn't going to bring back much?
Because of what? This weird trade deadline.
What do you mean? You're not going to get a blue chip number one?
No, not what I'm saying. And I'm not saying because of the way he's pitching or any of that, but just because it's going to be a buyer's market.
You're going to get a lottery ticket, as Jeff Passan would tell us. You're going to get a lottery ticket and get a single A player who's like, yeah, maybe he hits and yeah, maybe he doesn't, but he's got this one tool that has really flashed.
That's what you do.
Trade him.
1-year deal, right? Taiwan's on a 1-year deal.
It's on a 1-year, $2 million deal.
Yep. So you know what? You trade him and you get a lottery ticket back, and God bless him and thank you for being good the first half of the season, at least getting that. And then at the end of the year, if you want to revisit that, depending on how Logan Gilbert, depending on how Justice Sheffield, depending on Justin Dunn, depending on Marco, depending on, you know, the kind of the course over the next 30 games with your other players and your young developmental pieces as well, then you can revisit Taiwan. It's not like someone's going to lock him up.
Yeah, I don't know about trading him again and then try. I mean, at some point, I think that ship sailed. I would try to re-sign him.
Yeah.
I honestly would try to re-sign him right now if you could get him on a reasonable deal.
Right now?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, not this minute because of the...
But, you know, I mean, in season?
Yeah, I would. Okay. Or keep him and try to sign him in the offseason. I don't think you're going to get back enough for it to matter. The only reason to the biggest reason to trade him is that he's too good right now, and he's going to start winning you games that maybe you don't want to win.
Exactly.
And he's working against your long term story.
Bring 110
But I don't know. I've watched Taiwan. I don't think he's great. I don't think he's a top of the rotation pitcher or anything close to it. But he's 27 years old. If you sign him to a 2-year, $8 million deal, now I don't know if he does that, but he's only making $2 million this year. If you could get him for 2 years and $8 million, because there's not going to be much money out there in the offseason. Let's be clear. The owners are very poor. They don't have enough money. The poor guys. It's so sad. The owners don't have any money. There's not going to be much spending done in the offseason.
And you think you'd hurt his feelings if you traded him and you couldn't sign him back in the
offseason? No, it's not a feelings thing. I don't know. I think that at a certain time,
money talks.
That stops money talks. Happening. Nah. Look, it's possible. But I would try to just get a deal done. I would like him to be a bridge into your future as you're betting on these young guys and waiting to see which of them develops and knowing that some of them are going to get hurt and some of them aren't going to be what you want them to be. I really like this version of Taiwan Walker. He seems mature. He's throwing the ball great. He's physically filled out. He's only 27. So if you could get him for 2 or 3 more years, you're talking about his ages 28 through 30 seasons.
And
that's what I want.
He's now past the big arm injury. The thing you wait for with every pitcher, the one big arm injury. He had it now, and he's done. He's come around the back side of it. I'm totally with you, Mike. I don't think it's possible to sign him if he gets to the end of the season. I think you have to do it during the season. Otherwise, he's going to open season baseball, yeah. And some team's going to say, that's a potential 3. I'll give him a 3-4 year deal.
And there may be some level of loyalty factor to it. You rescued the guy this year. No, you know, you went to his tryout. You rescued him. You gave him a spot. He feels comfortable here, clearly. Seems to be really happy in Seattle. I don't know. I would reach out and see if you could get it done. I've been really happy with what he's had.
You think his French bulldogs have filled out as much as he has?
It's a good question.
Remember how athletic his were? I remember talking to you about that. Gosh. Like, why does he have athletic?
I was doing work yesterday in my basement. That's where I work throughout the day. Uh-huh. And no one else was in the house except Wendell. He was upstairs lying in the sun. And I could hear and feel him snoring from downstairs.
Yeah.
Shocking moment.
2 stories away.
Shocking moment. I was like, man, the house is shaking. What is going on? Oh, it's just Wendell snoring.
He's his father's son. All right. There's no question
about
that.
There's no need for that. What's your what?
What is the most encouraging news you've heard out of Hawks camp?
Oh, it's Marquise Blair. Not close.
Yeah.
Right?
Really?
I mean, it's their second round pick from last year. Marquise Blair looking like a stone cold killer, crushing people out there, figuring out the nickel spot, finding ways to get him out on the field. Yeah, it's Marquise Blair for sure. Because that was a big pick last year. That was their, I mean, we sort of.
It's the highest secondary guy they've drafted since Earl.
So, I would say it's him for sure.
Okay.
Well, why are you so surprised, Howard? What would you have said?
I mean, you brought in Jamal Adams, and that's a huge question mark. Like,
not really, though.
If he's not what he was built up to be, and if he doesn't fit in the right way, and if it's just not gelling, that's a huge deal.
That's fair. I'll buy that. That he has been everything. That's true. That's a good one. But I guess I was sort of counting on that. Maybe I read this as a little more of a surprise than just encouraging. But, yeah, certainly Jamal Adams being what he's billed as has been pretty good.
Everyone coming out of that practice and saying, this defense is fast.
Yeah.
This defense is – Jamal Adams has changed this defense.
Now, to be fair, with their defensive line, they're very quickly moving backwards. They are very fast, but getting blown off the ball.
Well, they're just getting blown off. Yeah,
whoa, that guy's fast.
And he's in the – what's moving?
Oh, my God.
Back in the second level.
All right. Brock, did you have an answer? Was it also Marquise Blair? Well, I'm sorry. What was yours?
Oh, you know, yeah, I think that and just the overall health. I mean, guys, they're a couple weeks into this and so much kind of concern going in and knowing some of the people whose job it was over the last couple months to try to put a plan together is all of these NFL teams. So to actually see them practicing, to see a mock game, and I know Brandon got knocked out in that game, kind of ended it early, but you know, that has been hugely encouraging as they've had a plan and they've been able to execute it the first couple weeks out.
Where does Jadeveon Clowney end up?
So you bypass the when, huh? You
I went go
who,
where,
what,
when?
Where?
You go when, where? Or we yeah. do it your way.
No, that's fine. Howdy, Kyle. What do you guys?
What do you guys? I'm sorry. Maybe it's an easy
one. What, when, where?
Yeah.
Who, what, where, when? Wait, what?
Who, what, when, where? Why?
When, where, why?
When, where, why?
Who, all right, well, go with the when. I've always done a where. All right, when? When do we have fans at CenturyLink Field?
Ooh. What phase are we in right now? Are we in phase two? Phase one and a half?
Well, I don't know. Not sure.
I think that will
They've
be
abandoned that. That's gone.
I think that or whatever box. I think that will be dictated by the government and the governor. Yeah, I don't think Pete Carroll and I don't think Jody Allen and I don't think the Seahawks are going to do anything without the blessing of the state of Washington.
I agree.
In the way that they've processed from the beginning.
I don't think there's any way there's fans at CenturyLink Field this year. That's just my guess. I know they've said first four games. Mm. That's half the year. So I'm going to guess that.
I think it'll happen in the playoffs. I think by the time the playoffs roll around that people will start loosening restrictions.
Now, I will say that Pete, you know, is one that's playing by those rules. I think very comfortable in all of that right now. If they're finding that the Miami Dolphins or the Dallas Cowboys or the Houston Texans or Atlanta, who they play week one, who I think is going to have 20 to 25% of the stadium in there, and all of a sudden these teams have an advantage, right? Because they're
That's what I wanted to ask you about. How is the NFL going to deal with that?
Well, they're going to let the states and is what I, I'll learn a little bit more about that this week. But I think as of now, everything has been, we're going to turn it over to the states, the counties.
There's an issue there though, from a competitive standpoint.
Yeah. Well, they're discussing a lot of
pipe.
They've got to
start putting in some pipe. First of all, you've got to do it to make it watchable, right?
And then they've got to.
No, they are. They're absolutely going to allow crowd noise.
They already legislated that in the NFL, and they said that.
But are they going to make it even?
If you're going to,
or you're going to be whatever your average crowd noise was last year.
The home team is allowed to determine what the decibel level is of the actual noise that you pump in, but it has to be equal on offense and defense. You can't change it during the game.
But that's ridiculous. That's not the way it works. If you're trying to make it the same as what it would be if it was, you know, was what Miami or Atlanta or anybody else going to do. That's ridiculous. That's a competitive imbalance.
Yeah, and that's where I think Coach Carroll, I think he's all good right now, and you know, let's see how this plays out. But I can guarantee you the way he's wired, if there is an advantage for those teams that are allowing fans in and they're creating more noise, I think he's going to push and push hard.
Or the other way, if you're the Chargers and you get to pipe in crowd noise, and now your stadium's louder than it normally would be, and they're like, no, we don't want fans, we want to pipe in crowd noise.
You think the Chargers are happier without fans?
It's the only way it gets louder.
Fair enough. All right.
Along those lines, I guess my question was somewhat similar in the when, as far as the timing goes. When will the NFL have its first COVID challenge?
So that can be one of two things, right? Either a team that gets an outbreak similar to what we've seen with the Marlins and some of the other baseball teams, or it could be a player, coach, somebody seriously sick, hospitalized, or God forbid passes away, right? Either of those things would be a COVID challenge.
Oh, no question. No question about it. I mean, we've just seen it, right? We saw it in golf early with the caddy, and they kind of had to figure out what they were going to do with their testing. As you've mentioned, there have been now a couple baseball teams, the Marlins and the Cardinals, and a few that have had it, and they've been able to navigate it and mitigate it. We've not really seen it in NASCAR or the MLS or the NBA or the NHL. And right now, even though there was a scare over the weekend with a 70-some false positive tests, you know, so far it's been a remarkable run for the NFL. But eventually, you know, this is a virus, and eventually it's going to hit, you would think, somewhere, some program. When do you think that is?
I don't know about the when. I mean, I think that's going to be pretty tough to gauge. I think once they start traveling, I guess, and I mean, once teams are on the move, but you know, they're not flying coach. I mean, like, that would still be my guess as to the when.
Yeah,
I think that the outbreak is more likely than the hospitalization, but I think the hospitalization will be a much more significant blow to your chances of this thing all continuing than an outbreak, right? Baseball found a way to get through an outbreak. Yeah, we had an outbreak. Guess what? We just kept doing it.
Yep.
Like, I think that's totally fine. I don't have a problem with the way – I know people have gotten upset about it. I think baseball's handled it okay. Yeah, we had no outbreak. We quarantined everybody who needed to be quarantined. We stopped that team from playing for a little while, and then we moved on.
I think baseball's done a phenomenal job.
I do, too.
As much heat as they got early for not playing and the two sides fighting and condensing a season and all of the nonsense – that in all of the bitterness out there, I think in the public forum over that, before they got going. But since they played, credit Rob Manfred, credit the people in charge, credit the protocols, as Shannon Dreyer wrote about it. It was an immense challenge. And they got hit right in the mouth early with 17 people in that Marlins organization, and would have been very easy to just simply say, yeah, we're just going to shut this thing down. It's just not going to work. And they didn't, and they persevere. And I think they've done a phenomenal job.
Really across the board. I think the games look good on TV. Sound good on the radio. The quality of play has been really good. I think baseball's actually, I know everyone wants to kill baseball at every opportunity, but I think they've done a pretty good job, and I think football will be able to handle that equally well. Now, that does not account for somebody getting seriously hurt.
Yeah.
Or seriously going to the hospital with on a ventilator or something like that. I think that will be a much bigger challenge for whichever sport has to deal with it.
And I think it'll be more challenging for the NFL simply based upon the age of so many of the coaches and the size of staffs involved and the size of personnel involved within an organization and within their buildings. That just from a scope standpoint, you've got a lot more bodies and you've got a lot of coaches, that are going to be in much more risk area than I think some of the other teams and leagues have had to deal with.
Brock, I'll go back to my where. Where does Jadeveon Clowney end up?
Man, I'm going to say Seattle.
I sure hope you're right.
Gosh, I know many people feel the ship has sailed and it's done and it's over and he's got hurt feelings and they didn't sign him early and they've gone round and round and round and round. But I would have to think Jamal Adams helps. I'd have to think some of that juice and some of the energy on the back end of that defense has helped. I would certainly think that he looks around the league at all these teams and knows what he has and knows the playoff run he went on a year ago, even with not as much talent around him defensively. So, man, I sure hope there's still enough in the kitty and enough dollars to be able to move around and enough cap flexibility that ultimately he ends up in Seattle.
I will agree with you. I still hold out hope, and I think that's the best bet. It just feels right. Like getting close to the season and all of a sudden, like the news comes down and Schefter breaks the news or something like that. Like, yeah.
I mean, you're kind of getting to that point now.
I know.
Though. I mean, he's going to, wherever he goes, he's going to have to quarantine and test, right? For 3 or 4 days. He's going to have a physical.
It could be a Cam situation where he shows up weeks 1 or 2. I mean, like that wouldn't shock me either, but I'm with you. I think that's probably where this happens.
Who, what, when, where? Where will be the most difficult place to play in the NFL in 2020?
Green Bay.
With no crowd.
I don't know. What is this about? I'm not sure how to answer it.
Yeah, I just wonder kind of to our point about the crowd and the noise and the different circumstances and maybe those teams that have had, like Seattle, have had such an enormous home field advantage with the crowd and with the noise, and all of a sudden they don't. And you kind of look at some of those places, actually a Green Bay that has been so hard to play in, and they, like Seattle, are not going to have fans to start the season.
I guess I just think the cold and stuff is still the thing that makes Green Bay the hardest to play in. I mean, Buffalo, Green Bay, et cetera, like Chicago, the places where it should
be. Ripped up fields.
Yeah, I mean, I always think those are the things, even more than the crowd, that end up affecting.
What if Jerry has 50% capacity?
Jerry might go 100.
You just get them to change the law.
110,000 people in here. We're going to put 2 people in every seat.
They're
like,
going to declare
not?
Sundays the rules off in that state.
Sure.
Yeah.
You think who do you think is more powerful in Texas, Jerry or Governor Abbott?
Jerry Jones.
Jerry Jones. Not close.
Yeah, Jerry Jones. Yeah.
I say that having been to Texas like one time.
He brings
his
cabal of power brokers,
right.
His shadow cabal. And then he'll just put the pressure and say, this
be
is
like,
how we do it.
What happened to the separation of church and state? What are we doing?
Brock, why are folks still dunking on the Rangers and Chris Woodward? It's been like 10 days, and people can't stop
because
dunking on the Rangers.
Because they are so pathetically lame.
No,
and
they're
they
not.
And they brought this all on themselves for being such unbelievable
losers.
Can
we please go back again to what Chris Woodward said, which is not anything about drilling the kid or that it was inappropriate or anything
like
that.
Well, I didn't like it.
Not what he said.
That's what he said.
He did say that. But in context, he said, I didn't grow up learning the game that way. I didn't like it. Neither did some of the folks here. But this is the way the kids are playing today. He recognized that the game has changed. He recognized that the common mores have changed. And he moved on. He didn't drill them the next day.
You can't poke at millennials in this day and age. Have you learned?
Gosh.
The millennials are fighting back. So you better not poke at them and poke that bear. So
they're not even millennials anymore. Chris,
no.
These are the next generation.
These are Gen Xers trying to be millennials. Like, hey, I'm one of the cool guys. Like, I'm cool. I got a hat on. See, I'm wearing a hat. So I'm a millennial.
I have a hoodie.
And I also think it is, unfortunately for Chris Woodward, he's just got no equity in the game. Like, it'd be one thing if Tito or Dusty Baker or, you know, somebody that's got some pelts on the wall and decades and decades, and that's no slight against Chris. I mean, he's a Major League Baseball player, for crying out loud, and ascended to the managerial role. I think he's a guy that probably is a little easier to pick on just because of the lack of experience.
I don't think it is that at all. I think people are just excited to line up and without reading or listening to the quote, just get upset because they're excited about that. Ah, I get a reason to be mad. Woohoo!
Yeah, possibly.
Something sort of proves my point. I'm going to bend it till it does and go.
I think that's exactly apply the same argument to Chris Woodward. I've got a reason to be mad.
He wasn't
they
that
swung
mad,
at a 3-0 pitch.
No,
I didn't like it.
Stop it. Also, you shouldn't swing in a 3-0 pitch.
We didn't do that and when I was playing in AAA Durham for my whole career. that would have never stood. Thanks, Chris.
I like unwritten rules. I'm all about them. I think they're great. I think they make for good conversation. I think they help baseball be set apart. And I hope they don't go away. I think that is a positive thing for the game.
Okay, shifting gears to college football. Why? Why will the Big Ten and Pac-12 be on the outside looking in both short and long term?
What's the Pac-12? What was the tweet you had the other day about the Pac-12? Oh, the Pac-12 got left out of that video.
Yes,
oh. So sad. I did that whole video about the Big Ten and the SEC. And they were picking them up to go to the game. Mm-hmm. And they didn't even bother to put the Pac-12 in it. They had the AAC in there.
They were quarantining, to be fair.
Oh,
okay? They were
that was sad.
From the video.
Were they?
I don't know.
They didn't even mention them.
No, they weren't.
Oh, dude, that was so sad.
That was just sad. So
rough. Why will the Pac-12 be on the outside looking in short and long term? Because the fans don't care as much as they do in the other ones. In the other conferences. Why will the Big Ten? It won't be. The Big Ten will be back and it'll be just fine.
Big Ten will have no issues.
None.
I don't know. I mean, Ohio, you're probably right. Ohio State is such a force in Penn State and Michigan. Yeah, I would probably tend to agree with
you.
And this is going to hurt the Pac-12 significantly more than the Big Ten.
No, it won't. It won't change anything for the Pac-12.
Yes.
The Pac-12 is what it is. It is.
No, it will significantly hurt them even more. And I realize that this last year's recruiting class, the number one and two quarterbacks out of the state of California already went to Alabama and Clemson. So I already know they've been poached.
You think?
Yeah. But it's only going to hurt more.
All right. So. Here's your how, Brock. How much money is Jamal Adams going to ask for now that Buda Baker has been just got his deal? He is the highest paid safety. Now, the early numbers are at like $14.75 million a year. $13.75 million a year? Hold on. Let me make sure I get the number right.
Well, you can always move those numbers around based on guarantees. He wanted 17 or 18 million, right?
It's 14 and three quarters what Buda Baker got.
Yeah. He wanted 17 or 18 million.
Yeah, I know.
That's what he wanted in New York.
He's not going to get that. But he might get 16.
Depends on what kind of playmaker he is. Depends how much around the ball he is. And Bobby's at 18 million as a middle linebacker and kind of set the bar there. No one's come close to touching that. I think that's going to end up looking like not a great deal and maybe a little bit of overpayment. But I would think if Jamal Adams is the alpha of this defense, he's the voice of this defense, he's the playmaker in the run game, he's the playmaker in the passing game in a league that is, you know, trying to diversify, become more positionless defensively, and especially in this division in which he's going to have to at times be a safety, at times be a linebacker, at times be a pass rusher. You know, I think just pigeonholing you as a strong safety, and strong safeties make $14 million, and that's just where the bar is. Yeah, if he's as good a playmaker as all expectations and indications are heading into this season, and he's a 100-tackle guy with 4 picks and 4 forced fumbles and 4 sacks and helps his defense get back to having the juice that they once had, he's going to make $17 million, yeah. $17, $18
million. I've never been the biggest Buda Baker fan, but you know, give him credit. I mean, you know, he ends up getting close to $15 million a year, so obviously the league thinks highly enough of him. So he's drafted one spot after Malik McDowell, right?
36th. Yeah. Malik McDowell, 35th.
Sheesh. Just imagine. I mean, look, I don't know whether Buda Baker was the right fit here. Maybe he was, and maybe he didn't fit with what they wanted to do, et cetera, et cetera. But gosh, when you keep going back to that trade and all of the horrible things that happened, or that pick, and all the horrible things that happened because of it, it's just awful. I mean, you get nothing out of him. Then you have to trade for Sheldon Richardson. So you give up more picks in order to get Sheldon Richardson, who doesn't really fill the hole that you need him to fill. And then you realize that all of the ways you had to go try to fill your safety spot because of the disaster of Tedrick Thompson and Lano Hill. And then you find out that the guy who you could have just picked there.
Yeah.
You could have solved so many different problems just by taking Buda Baker. And he's not my favorite player. But gosh,
and he wanted to be here.
Everything that happened because of it is such a mess.
Yeah, yeah. And he wanted to be here. And he looked at himself as the next Earl. You know, he's an alpha. And all of those things that Arizona knew and drafted and developed, and ultimately now he gets paid. Okay, last one. Last one for me. How come it's gone belly up for Earl?
Well, I'm glad
how come
you
it's just
asked,
not? Gosh. How come it's just not worked for Earl over the last few years?
Well, it starts with this. Earl was not funny. I know everybody thought Earl was funny when he was here, and I didn't tell you were wrong until he left. So shame on me for that. But Earl's not that funny, and I want to remind everybody of that.
Sooner,
I should have warned you sooner. I was afraid of the pushback. That was on me. I got scurred.
You knew Howdy and I each had one Seahawks jersey in our closet.
I got scurred.
For each of us, it was Earl time.
I got scurred. Like, full on. Like, I was ducking like Mayweather. I admit it. I was ducking.
Ain't no time to get timid. None of that.
Not that funny. And it turns out that maybe he rubbed some other folks the wrong way, too. It's not just me. He got kicked out of Baltimore.
You're a monster, boy. It's coming out.
He's been thrown out of arguably the two most stable organizations in the league, or certainly right up there.
Yep.
So, I mean, why? Because Earl must be very annoying to be around, would be my guess. Yeah, that's really annoying. He's just kind of annoying. And so it kind of leads back to a couple of different conversations, Brock. One on Pete Carroll and how he held this group together. And maybe, and I forget who it was I saw who tweeted this. I'm sorry.
Sando, I think.
How important Cam was.
Yep. I think it was Sando because I liked that one too. Yep. Yeah. And I would just say as he's gotten older, while he's just taken no responsibility. I mean, as we get older, I think some of that, and certainly for guys that usually endure and last in the league, it's usually because as they get older, they understand what they are, and then they understand what they're not. And they try to minimize those things they're not and highlight those things that they are so they can survive in the league longer. And, you know, usually you're a little bit humbled, and you take some responsibility, and it's, to me, kind of gone the other way for Earl. He's taking no responsibility on or off the field for any of his actions. On or off the field. And I think he's burned bridges, as you said, in two quality organizations. And it's going to be fascinating to see where he ultimately ends up.
And then put the Cam side of this. I mean, maybe that is why you go after Jamal. I'm just looking at it and saying that position is so important. The leadership, the on-air, the physicality, all of it. Earl just hasn't been the same since he wasn't playing with Cam. That was true here and then true in Baltimore. So perhaps maybe a little insight why the Seahawks end up giving up all they did to get Jamal Adams. All right, Brock, if you need one last date, school is starting. For some people, it's already started in various capacities, online or back in person. The summer's coming to an end. Those cold mornings we were just talking about. Get one last date night in before school is in full effect. All right, last Friday for the Ascend and Upchurch Vineyard exclusive.
Ooh, I'm excited about this because we've had Wagyu steak. Yes. We had some short rib. What do we got?
This week's main course is a Mary's organic chicken.
Ooh.
All right, so this is the 3-course Taste of Summer dinner package. It's every Friday in August, right? They've been doing this. A meal paired with a bottle of Upchurch Vineyard wine, which is a great value. Yes, you get a Mary's organic chicken, and this is the last Friday to do it. They've got more cool stuff for September. but get one last three-course date night in before August is over. Look out for the Ascend Prime Instagram. They always have giveaways, at least through the end of the month here. For more info, go to ascendprime.com, and then you can check out the menu items, promotions, location, or you can go to Bellevue yourself, check out the ridiculous view, especially given how clear it has been out. Perfect time to get to Ascend in Bellevue. Check out the view. Again, it is ascendprime.com. All right, Brock, first time we've had Jake on the podcast. Jake Heaps, our very own, from Tom, Jake, and Stacy, every day on 710 ESPN Seattle from noon to 3. Former quarterback, Russell Wilson's best friend and confidant, and I'm pretty sure eventually he's going to be his agent, I would guess, at some point. That's part of the package, right? You just get, like, Mark, move on out. We don't need you anymore. We actually want a deal maker. Let's get Jake in there. You're sort of the, like, the angel on the shoulder, whereas Mark Rogers sort of the devil on the other shoulder. Like, you're sort of the good side for Russ, so you can balance off whatever Mark Rogers is saying. So.
Welcome to the podcast, Jake.
Hi, Jake. Wow. How are you?
Oh, wow. What an introduction. Yeah. Thanks, guys. I'm fired up to be here. Good. Let's do this thing.
So you've been out, the reason we wanted to talk to you is that you've been out of practice every day. So you know, we're not allowed out there. We're just podcast guys. We're not allowed to practice anymore. We're not allowed to observe what's happening. We can't give our tidbits and takeaways and all the other cool stuff.
Pete and John don't talk to us anymore. No. They've kind of just done away with
us.
They're
done. Do you remember the year, Brock, that Lumberg One wanted us to have wireless mics and walk around practice during practice doing the show?
Yeah.
I wasn't ready for that. That was good. That didn't work out. So all of those things put together, we're banned. Or shadow banned, maybe.
Banned.
We're shadow banned.
Absolutely.
Shadow banned.
They haven't said anything official, but it's happened.
We're shadow banned. So, Jake, tell us, what's the number one most important thing you're seeing every day?
Well, the number one most important thing that I'm seeing is the defense. And I think that has been the biggest question. Salk and Brock, you guys have been advocating for this defense to get revamped through the offseason, under Pete Carroll's philosophy, that this needs to be balance. This needs to be complementary football. That Russell doesn't need to cook. That defensively, they just need to get better. Am I close on that?
Pretty much.
Yeah. That's well said.
So gathering your guys' philosophy for the team to get better, I think that there's two sides of this for the defense as I'm watching it. Number one, which is the positive, is that from the linebacking core to the secondary, this defense has drastically improved. Team speed, talent-wise, playmaking ability, energy. Brock, do you remember last year we were out at training camp together and we're watching that defense in 2019 just absolutely get shredded every single day in practice, and we're looking at Shalom Luwani and
Tedrick Thompson.
We're looking at Lano Hill.
We are recording this in the morning. Please stop. You're making me nauseous.
Well, I mean, we were just looking at a bunch of playmaking studs out there that were just a bunch of alphas that didn't really say much. They weren't really bringing any juice. And I remember Brock and I looking at each other going, what is this? What are we looking at right now? There's no juice. There's no enthusiasm. There's no trash talking. There's nothing
compared to
the original Legion of Boom that we watched with Sherman. Oh, it is.
You're asking Tedrick Thompson to talk trash after another ball goes over his head and he falls down? Like, you can't talk trash from the ground. That's not fair. You're just being mean.
Well, you'd be surprised what DBs are willing to do. I mean, they could have nothing to do with the play and the ball is incomplete and they're saying that they were the reason why it happened. I mean, don't underestimate a DB's ability to overhype a situation. But there was none of that. There was absolutely none of that. And Brock and I are looking at each other like, dude, this isn't good. And guess what? In 2019, they were awful. They were absolutely awful. And Pete and Ken Norton Jr., guess what? They knew it too. So they played a soft, conservative approach. It drove us crazy. I think Brock and I had our own secret dark text thread that we...
You had a dark web text thread. Wow.
Yes.
No wonder we got shadow banned.
That's right. It was not good. It was not a good, safe place. And although, you know, usually when Brock and I, when we, you know, text with our showmates, you guys put us in line. There was none of that. Brock and I were just feeding off of each
other. Downward spiral.
Exactly. So, but you look at this group now, and it's really positive. There's actually days that they're going out and winning the day, you know, very, very handedly. You're wondering what Pete and Ken Norton Jr. are going to be willing to do with this defense. And I can't get into details, unfortunately, exactly how they're lining up and all those things, because the NFL has made it really convenient that every practice now is a in-season type of reporting. But I'll just say this, that they have been very creative in the ways that they have tried to maximize Jamal Adams, Marquise Blair, and Bobby Wagner. So those three guys have been highlighted in what I've seen so far in practice, which is what they've needed to do. And you can see that they are inspired to be aggressive, that they have juice. I mean, yesterday I'm watching practice, and there's a couple plays in a row where the defense is getting the best of the offense, and you're looking at Jamal Adams, and he's dancing, showboating up on the offensive side of the ball. Quandre Diggs and Bobby Wagner and Bruce Irvin and all those guys are hooting and hollering and having actual presence out there on the field. That part of it has been positive. That part of it's been good.
Is Jamal Adams this good?
Yes. Just very straightforward, Jamal Adams is good. Now, we need to see him as a member of the Seahawks, right? In a 2020 season, playing live games. But so far in practice, from what my eye tells me, this guy is every bit worth the two first-round picks, that you could call it desperation. I call it the obvious need that they needed to get a playmaker, a game tilter in a player like Jamal Adams, and they've got that for sure.
I don't mean to be the dank, dark, awful cloud over this interview, but
you don't of course mean not. To be.
But
you never play that role. That's weird.
When we asked you the first question, hold on a minute. This is you. I'm just reminding you of the second half of your first answer, because it sounded anyway to this seasoned interviewer like you had sort of a two-part answer on what you were seeing with the defense. The first part had to do with the good, I think you said, with the back end of the defense. It sounded, again, right. Maybe I'm out over my skis here, like there was going to be a second part to that
like
answer.
There were two shoes on that foot?
Yes, yeah. And one of them was ready to drop.
Yeah, I was willing to let you guys bask in the good before I got to the bad. And Salky didn't want to go there, so I'll dive right in.
It was nice.
So,
I liked hearing about Jamal Adams. He's great. I'm excited about him. That was good.
Okay, good. I'm glad.
How's the front of that defense?
So
how's Monet and Christmas and crew?
And I'm the dark one. Jeez.
It's still a problem. It's still a problem. There is nothing in my mind as I look at this group that has changed. In terms of the number one problem that the Seahawks have had all offseason, identified by Pete, identified by John, all throughout the offseason has been pass rush, has been defensive line. And that, to me, is still the glaring weakness of this equation. Now, they can dress it up. They can try and hide it by unique skill sets of those three guys that I mentioned, Bobby Wagner, Jamal Adams, and Marquise Blair. But those three guys can't mask the overall problem of your defense. Your defense is designed for beat five. Four rushers can beat five, and we can play our coverage, our scheme behind it. You're asking guys to play positions or roles that they've never played in before, guys. And that, to me, is evident. Now, it doesn't mean they're not good football players. Like Benson Mayowa, for example. Right, we've talked about it. You guys have mentioned it. I've mentioned it, that he is a rotational pass rusher. If he was your third pass rusher in the equation of your defensive line, I'd be all for it. I'd be all for it, because he's a very good rotational pass rusher. Plays, you know, his sweet spot is 20-30% of the snaps in a given game. He is very highly efficient, a good pass rusher, a good football player. Now you're asking him to be your starting Leo. Right? Being an every down Leo and difference maker. You're asking Bruce Irvin, who has always been a consistent 6.5 sack type of player and a very good player and one that I'm happy they brought back. But now you're asking Bruce Irvin to play a role as your leading pass rusher in a role that he's never played before, right? So those are things that you look at and draws major concern. Outside of Jaron Reed and Puna Ford, your depth at the defensive tackle position is it's scary. I mean, John brings in P.J. Johnson. Okay, he's a big-bodied human being. I mean, he's massive, massive guy, like Al Woods. But the last two seasons, he spent time on practice squads and not out there on the field. So is it possible that he's fresh and he's very, very fresh. He's got no wear and tear on him, Saul. So could it be that at 6'3", 335 pounds, you know, he's 24 years old, first year out of Arizona, could he be the key? Could he be the guy that Pete and John and the scouting department found? Diamond in the rough? Maybe. But it doesn't bode a ton of confidence at the end of the season.
They
are not done at this position, guys.
They cut today Brandon Jackson, Monet, Christmas, Lattimore, P.J. Johnson, if they cut all those guys, do any of them even get picked up? I mean, I think that's a fair question.
We know Brandon Jackson's a no. They did that.
Correct.
With him. He was a no.
And he's PJ their
was
most sitting on the seasoned street. Guy.
He's the best
he
of the group.
He has sacks in the NFL.
I mean, yes, we all looked and watched last year. It was like the 25th to 27th ranked defense in the most important stats. And we all watched it. And the best players on that D-line last year were Al Woods and Jadeveon Clowney. I mean, of the crew that, you know, they had last year. Now, Bruce wasn't there and Benson wasn't there. And obviously, LJ took
Jaron
a redshirt year.
Jaron had kind of a funny year.
What's that? Don't forget about Quentin Jefferson, too.
That's true.
Two and a half sacks. Yep. Q-Tip had a couple
but
sacks.
He was starting.
Yeah. And he's not there anymore. So, I mean, that was the weakest link of a season ago. And what have you really done to address it?
It's a fascinating question because, Brock, you look at this group, and what they've done is they've tried to establish a rotation. They've tried to do that. And so, Salk, when you and I had a heated debate about rookies and Daryl Taylor and do you rely on him or not, well, with the current setup of which this defensive line is, yes, those guys are relying on Daryl Taylor. They were hoping that Daryl Taylor would come in and be a part of this pass rush because
how's he looking?
He's injured and on the sideline.
Can
so
you imagine what it would have been like if he was the actual first round pick? If they had actually selected him in the first round like they said they wanted to do, what that would have looked like? Oh.
Let me jump in here because obviously you guys are death spiraling like
back into our dark
like
text.
Maverick
yeah,
and Goose.
Apologies.
You're out to sea. You've gone through the jet wash, and I'm here to save you both because, as usual, I will be the voice of positivity. How did the Seahawks fix the problem from last year? The front of the defense was lousy, and they looked around the league and said, "We can't fix this."
Too expensive.
We don't have the resources. The best options for us aren't out there. We don't like this. We don't like that. So rather than fixing the problem, we're going to shore up everything around the problem and make it matter less. Right? They're going to reinforce everything else. I know there's a hole here, but I don't have the right thing to patch it, so I'm going to make sure to reinforce everything around the hole so that the hole's not that big a deal. Can that work?
It can, but it's also a very unusual way of building a roster.
Sure,
now,
but they're the Seahawks. Of course it's unusual.
It's true, but that's going to be, I'm telling you, it's going to be the experiment of a lifetime. Because if this is successful, this will change, I promise you, this will change the way a lot of GMs around the league view building rosters in terms of building it from the back forward, because we have seen now that the defensive line, and I want to say this very clearly, it was not exorbitant or out of control when they were first making these decisions to pass up all these other pass rushers in free agency. It didn't become exorbitant until Joey Bosa all of a sudden signed for a $27 million contract out of nowhere. Now it's become a problem in terms of trying to find those elite defensive linemen and trying to re-sign those guys. So now if this works for the Seahawks, you're going to start building from the back forward because it's less expensive. But this is you look at this group, and I'm telling you that unless this secondary is one of the best of all time, you can't hide all the warts that you have across your defensive line. And the group that I'm looking at, could Jaron Reed have a better season? Could he be the 2018 version? Gosh, I'm sure hoping so. They paid him like they're wanting him to be. Could Benson Mayoa step up? Could Bruce Irvin step up? They need to. Could Puna Ford rise to the occasion? Sure. But you've got a lot of unproven aspects to that, and you have a lot of unproven depth there. And so this is going to be a gamble, guys. And that's why I say right now, Tuesday, August 25th, that this group cannot be done. Pete and John cannot be done.
I agree with that.
Cannot be done addressing this issue, that they're going to make some sort of late acquisition before the season starts.
This is a podcast. It doesn't have a date. Just let's be clear. It could be any day. This is a podcast, Jake. This isn't a little radio show.
They go
this
back
is,
and listen a year ago. We're still having stuff from 2019
that's
people
right.
are listening to every
this is,
day.
This is eternal.
Let me say two things along those lines, Salky, that you brought up. Number one, can it work? If you were in the AFC East, I would feel better about it. You are in the NFC West, and you're going to have to stop a run game in L.A. You have to stop a run game in San Francisco. And we watched Kenyon Drake last year wave at you on the sidelines as he took it 70 yards and ran for over 100 in a game you had to have in late December in your own building. So in your own division, you have to stop the run. I don't care how good the back seven is. You know, I remember playing games. Jake remembers playing games at quarterback. Like, okay, yeah, I'm protected. I have time. But if I don't have anybody that can win, what does it really matter? I have no one to throw to, or vice versa. I got guys getting open, but I don't have any time because I'm getting hammered here. And if you're Bobby and you're Jamal and people are getting on you and you're getting blocked because your four can't hold any water at all in your own division, first and foremost, that's going to be really challenging. I would also say they did address it, and they did it in a way that has always been a Seahawk way, and that is volume. Instead of paying for one premium guy, they said, nope, we're going to do it with Bruce. We're going to do it with Benson. We're going to do it with a draft pick in the second round, a draft pick in the fifth round. You know, we're going to bring in a bunch of cheap guys, and, you know, we're going to do it by volume. So I don't think they turned a blind eye to that. But I would absolutely second what Jake said. They have to get something. They have to be counting on a veteran D tackle being cut somewhere in the next couple weeks and not bringing snacks in off the couch at 400 pounds, but someone who's actually been in a camp for a month that has some legs underneath him so he can play. I would sure hope they're still listening to Clowney in the market on Clowney everywhere else and have enough dollars and cents saved up somewhere or a move to be made in
if
them.
If you get Clowney, is that enough? Does that change this whole equation enough?
I feel better about it, but it doesn't change your tackle situation. I mean, we saw Puna and Jaron both nicked up on one weekend. And like literally your backups, and this is no slight against DeMarcus Christmas and Cedric Lattimore and PJ Johnson and Brian Monet. But honestly, if any of those guys got released, I don't think they'd get picked up anywhere. So, you know, and those are your backups to Puna and Jaron. That is what is practicing for the last month. And these practice reps, Jake, and you see them every day, man, these are more vital than they've ever been in training camp. You didn't have OTAs. You didn't have mini camps. You didn't have any other real conditioning as a team. So, I mean, this is kind of valuable time with kickoff in Atlanta 2 weeks from Sunday.
So let me go to the other side of the ball here with Jake while we've got him. Maybe I shouldn't even ask this question because I feel like I might know the answer, but how does Russ look?
Well, whatever you think the answer is going to be is probably right. I mean, he looks great. I mean, the guy's looked great. And he's looked in control. He's looked in command. And I think for him at this stage, I mean, Brock, you brought up an interest, you know, a great point that I think I heard, you know, Salk chide you for, that Russell's got to continue to be great, that he can't just come in and have a down year. That is obvious, right? We all know that. But to do that year in and year out and to know that that's what the expectation is, it's a whole nother ball game. So, you know, I know you guys have been the body show and this and that over the years and giving Russ a hard time now and again about what his weight's at and this and that. The guy was a machine this offseason. And, you know, you could you know, chalk it up to COVID and him having to stay home. You could chalk it up to, you know, a couple different things. But this guy, what I've been around him over the last 3 years now, working with him, you know, trying to help him, you know, get better and improve his craft, he has been obsessive. And this offseason, I mean, just cranked it up. I mean, he was obsessive with getting better, obsessive with, you know, every aspect, you know, from a mechanical standpoint, from a footwork standpoint, to the mental standpoint. I think all those things are something that is there. And we, as, you know, podcast guys, as you guys are now, not even Everyday
right.
Radio,
yep.
which is podcast so bizarre.
Yep.
You guys are podcast guys. I'm now on the front lines, you know, doing Everyday Radio. And
infantry, sort of an infantry cavalry situation.
Oh, okay.
Is the way
yeah,
I feel.
Gotcha. So the generals get to be in the podcast.
Yeah. Well, we're just more cavalry. Men. We ride around on Howdy the Horse, and here we are on our cavalry, and we send the infantry in to do battle every day.
That's a beautiful steed you got there. When you look at this, for Russell, it is one of those situations for him that you don't want to talk about Super Bowl windows. Is it nice to have a Super Bowl window? 4 years, and we could talk about how Pete and John can build it through then. But I guarantee you, Russell Wilson and Bobby Wagner and Dwayne Brown and the leadership core of this team, they don't want to hear any of that. It's about winning now. And so I think that, you know, the intensity and the urgency from this group, it's awesome in my opinion. I think that they're pushing, that they're wanting more, that they're wanting to be the best version of themselves. And I've really gathered that from Russell, you know, just through this offseason.
Is Russell cooking now?
Is Russell cooking now?
In training camp.
I think they have, just like with anything else, that they have, A, stay the status quo, and B, that any of that cooking is something that they're probably saving. Which is funny, because we reporters, we can't report anything right now, so it's not like we would divulge any of this information.
They don't trust anybody.
Nope.
No, of course, and they shouldn't.
Pete said they're going to hammer the rock, didn't he? We're going to pound the rock. Let's go.
He did jokingly.
Oh.
But I do believe, guys, that, you know, in this cooking conversation, just like with everything else in our country, it's so polarizing. You cook, don't cook. You're conservative, you're liberal. You're you know, everything can't, there's no meat in the middle anymore. And I think for Russell, and I think for Pete, and I think for this offense, that they're working towards that meat in the middle. And I think that that's a really positive thing, that you can't just stay stagnant. You have to continue to grow. You have to continue to develop. And there needs to be a yin to a yang in this situation to balance each other out.
Okay, can I do four downs quickly? Like a no-huddle four downs, like quick answers to all of these? Is that possible?
Let's go.
It depends. Okay. Can Jake answer them quickly? We'll see.
Yeah, I mean, if you got me in a two-minute mode,
I'm not going to get you in any trouble, so not asking for any scheme or anything like reporting-wise, and this can just be your best guess on kind of what you know and what you're hearing, but if they were playing Sunday, this upcoming Sunday in Atlanta, which I think is a couple weeks away from that, but, you know, it's coming around the corner. They're playing this Sunday. Who's the starting corner opposite of Shaquille? Is it Dunbar or Flowers?
It's Trey Flowers. If you're asking me today, it's Trey Flowers, but Quentin Dunbar is starting to be integrated and is starting to actually introduce himself into the competition, so that could change.
They play Sunday in Atlanta. The starting O-line from right to left is?
Dwayne Brown, Upati, Ethan Posick, Damian Lewis, Brandon Shell.
Your most pleasant surprise watching the last 2 weeks?
Marquise Blair, hands down.
Why?
Because you talk about this transition to nickel. He's never played nickel. He's always been a safety. This guy has been impactful at that nickel corner position so far, and he brings a lot to the table. His physicality, his speed, his ability to blitz off the edge. And, guys, he's been fantastic. When he's – now, zone coverage, in terms of him understanding zones and where to drop and how guys are trying to attack him and all that, that is one that I'm not sure about right now. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I haven't seen enough. But in terms of his man-to-man match coverage ability, he's been fantastic. And that's been my number one question about Marquise. Can he survive in that role? Time will tell. But so far in camp, he's looked awesome at it.
Okay, fourth down, final thing. Body show. Back to the body show in the Calvary.
Oh, boy.
if I'm out there with you, the two or three guys who have changed the most, two or three guys who you could tell, like Russell, went to work this offseason and worked on their weaknesses and have grown their body, grown their game, you know, just are there a couple guys that just jump out the most?
Well, I would say Marquise Blair, absolutely. He reportedly gained 10 to 15 pounds, and you can see it. I mean, last year, I remember seeing him for the first time. I was like, man, this guy's a big hitter. Like, this guy is a stick. He's a stick. But he flies around, and he plays with reckless abandon. Now you see him with a little bit more muscle, a little bit more power behind him. And if he's going to play around the line of scrimmage more often, you can see why he made that move. But he's not slower because of that. He's been able to still maintain that twitch and speed. Another guy that, look, I haven't seen the payoff on this yet, but LJ Collier, he does look physically better than what he did a year ago. You know, last year he had a little bit of a belly. He just, you know, you look at a first round pick and you're like, that doesn't look like a first round pick to me from a physicality standpoint. And I think LJ has been able to, you know, transform his body a little bit more, which has been positive, and hopefully it translates onto the field. And then one guy that I would love to talk about that, you know, just hasn't necessarily been a guy from year one to year two, but as a rookie, is Jordan Brooks. That guy, I mean, he's put together. He is stout. You talk about his posterior chain, Brock, from his glutes to his hamstrings, the calves. I mean, you would have a field day with that evaluation. He's just he is powerful. He's twitched up. He's got stopping power, can run sideline to sideline. You can see that KJ is definitely going to be the guy right now. But Jordan Brooks, to me, is a player that you're going to see him flash throughout the 2020 season.
Any chance he can rush the passer a little bit? Maybe after the quarterback a little bit?
Well,
feels like maybe they could use
that.
Yeah.
Yes, they could use it.
Or play some middle linebacker and let Bobby rush the passer, which he's been really good at over the course of his career. I mean, like, if you don't have any pass rush, I'm counting on the strengths of this team. Jamal Adams and Jordan Brooks and Bobby Wagner. Like, let those guys do it because somebody's going to have to.
They are, and I think that they are. This group, this coaching staff, is going to be willing to do that. So my biggest concern out of this defensive line is not the pass rush, although it is a concern for me. I want to be clear. It is a concern. My biggest concern is run stopping from this defensive line group, and that to me is my biggest concern with this group overall. I think that they'll be able to put it all together to have a successful pass rush. It'll be done in a way that we haven't seen from Pete and Ken Norton Jr.
Before. Oh, hold on. There was a false start on a Fetty. I get actually one more fourth down here.
And I just wanted to hear more about Brandon Schell.
This one's super
huge. That's a big boy now.
Who has a bigger, if you had to bet your own dollars on this, who has a more productive season for the Seattle Seahawks in 2020? Carlos Hyde or Philip Dorsett?
Carlos Hyde. I believe Carlos Hyde will have a more productive season than Philip Dorsett. I believe that, look, they're not going to get away from what they know, right? And that is being able to run the football, be physical, and Carlos Hyde fits that. Also, what concerns me is, as great as Chris Carson is, when you miss practice time and you get yourself out of the flow of things, look, you don't just all of a sudden come back and plug and play. So I do believe that there's going to be a solid rotation there between Chris Carson and Carlos Hyde that will take some of the load off of Carson. And so I, with that being said, I do think it'll be more of a two-headed monster this season at the running back position than it has been in the past couple years.
Well, I'm impressed, Brock. If it weren't for your false start extra question, we would have gone through basically an entire interview with an ex-quarterback without talking about weaponry. That would have been – I was pretty impressed. No DK Metcalf. No Tyler Lockett.
Star.
I mean, we weren't going to
also going to be good.
Baller.
Jake, thank you. As always, you can hear Jake daily on 710 ESPN Seattle. On the front lines, the infantryman going 12-3 with Tom and Stacey. Jake, thank you. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on, guys. It was a blast being on the podcast version of you guys. It was a little less intense.
Get to the chopper!